The following recording is copyrighted material and cannot be duplicated or distributed in either physical or electronic formats. For additional copies of the material, please visit www.bestchristianconferences.com.
Well, we're thrilled today to have James Watkins with us. He's an award-winning author of 14 books. He won the Campus Life Book of the Year Award, won the Retailer's Choice Award. He's published over 1,000 articles, has won an Emmy Award. He serves as an editor with Wesleyan Publishing House. He's an instructor at Taylor University in Indiana, and is communications pastor at a large church also in Indiana. His most important roles, however, he says, are as husband, dad, and papa. Please welcome James Watkins.
Well, my favorite thing, my very, very favorite thing about third grade was lunch and story time. So it's story time, boys and girls. I need your help. When I go like this, I want you to go, that's good. And when I go like this, I want you to say, that's bad. Let's try it, boys and girls. Very good. I knew you could. Now, please listen very quietly to the story of Joseph and his great, big, ginormous, super deluxe dream. Once upon a time, there was a boy named Joseph. His father, Jacob, bought him a brand new robe, but not just any robe. It was red and yellow and green and blue and striped and polka dotted and... Oh, that was bad, because Joseph's brothers became really jealous, since a coat of many colors was only worn by important people. So they said, who's this little brother think he is wearing a robe like that? No, that was good, because Joseph had a dream that he was going to become someone important, all right, the leader of a great nation, and that someday his brothers would have to bow down to him. So Joseph tried to explain that to his older brothers. No, that was bad, because Joseph's brothers got so mad, they ripped up his brand new coat and threw him head first into a deep hole in the ground. No, that was good, because some of his brothers just wanted to kill him. But one of his brothers said, hey, we can't kill little Joy. So they just ripped up his brand new coat and threw him head first in a deep hole in the ground. No, that was bad, because some slave traders from Egypt came by at that time. And one of the brothers said, hey, you want to buy this kid in the hole? And so Joseph was sold into slavery by his own brothers and taken far, far, far away to Egypt. No, that was good, because Joseph was bought by a rich man named Potiphar. And Joseph was such a good worker, he was put in charge of all Potiphar's money and household. It was a really plush job with a good salary, housing, dental plan, and 401k retirement benefits. No, that was bad, because Potiphar's evil wife told all sorts of lies about Joseph and had him thrown in jail. No, that was good, because while Joseph was in jail, he met two of the king's servants, and Joseph showed them how he could tell the future with God's help. Now, that's a good thing to be able to do, especially if you're the leader of a great country. So one of the servants told the Pharaoh about it, and so the young man who had the dream of becoming an important leader was made an important leader, all right, the vice pharaoh of Egypt. Actually, it was good, because a famine was coming. No, it was good, because God had told Joseph for 7 years there would be nothing but huge harvests of crops. But half must be stored, because after that time would come 7 years when nothing, not even dandelions, would grow. No, it was good, because Egypt had enough to eat, and Joseph's brothers came to buy grain, and they bowed down before him, just as he had dreamed. And when they found it was little Joey, they had a big family reunion, and the whole family came to Egypt and right in the royal neighborhood. Yes, that was good. It is confusing, though, when things we think are good sometimes turn out bad, and things we think are bad eventually turn out good. But Joseph knew a secret. He told his brothers, you intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So even though his brothers ripped up his brand new robe, threw him headfirst in a deep hole in the ground, and sold him into Egypt, and even though Potiphar's wife told all sorts of lies about him and had him thrown in jail, God was able to work good out of the bad. Yes, that's very good. Now, you have probably already discovered the writing career is one good news, bad news joke after another. This is an actual journal entry from October 1993. In the freelance land, good news, bad news department, bad news, the $10,000 deal with Thomas Nelson fell through. They scrapped the whole project. Good news, Tyndall House editor called me to say that Death and Beyond had gone into a second printing after just 1 month in stores. Bad news, Tyndall House editor called back to say Sex is Not a Four-Letter Word is going out of print. Good news, Tyndall House promotion department called later with a radio interview arranged for Death and Beyond. So two good news, two bad news in one day. So we're going to take a look at some of the good news and bad news of writing and speaking dreams. And the first thing we need to remember is the dream is received. How many of you have a dream? How many of you believe it's inspired of God? Now, it may not be a burning bush experience, but you sense that God has put something on your heart. He has given you a dream. Now, I'm going to define dream as a goal or desire. Goals are simply dreams with a deadline. But those dreams are just fantasy until we put them down on paper. So dreams are kind of like butterflies that flutter in and out of the meadows of our minds. And it's not until we can hold them in place that we can do something about them. Now, that illustration breaks down because butterflies with pins through their wings don't fly very far. But written words are the pins that keep our thoughts in place. So we can think about them, we can pray about them, we can analyze them with Scripture, we can scrutinize them with the Holy Spirit. That is why I am a firm believer in mission statements, because mission statements are the pins that hold our dreams in place. Mine is this: to communicate the gospel of Christ in as effective and creative manner as possible with as many people as possible. And so mission statements become tremendous life management tools. Now, no offense to Dennis Hensley, who writes about time management, but I don't believe that my efforts are going to affect the rotation of the earth by 1 second. I don't believe in time management. But I do believe in managing myself and by the power of God to manage me. So mission statements not only hold our dreams in place when the winds of discouragement and distraction blow us off course, as soon as people find out that you are a writer, you are going to be distracted. You are going to be asked to be secretary of the PTA. Friends are going to ask you to help them with their resumes. You're going to be asked to write a news release for your local church's fish fry. But all those things, even though they may be well and good, keep us from pursuing our dreams. So if God has given you a dream, write it down. Make your dream specific. Number one, I need to get serious about writing. That is not a mission statement. I'm going to buy some of those books out there on writing. That is something specific. I'm going to give up 1 hour of TV every night, and I'm going to write during that 1 hour. Do you realize if you will do that, 1 hour a night, every night, you will have 48 8-hour days. That is a month and a half of writing. So that may be a specific goal you have in mind. I'm going to submit my book proposal within the next 6 weeks. Now, make sure it's realistic. I'm going to outsell Jerry Jenkins and Max Lucado combined is not a realistic goal. I'm going to call my local bookstore and set up a book signing. That's realistic. I'm going to create a website to promote my book. That's realistic. I'm going to ask the local women's group in my church to speak about my book. So, have you received a dream? I want you to repeat in your best Martin Luther King voice possible, I have a dream. Let's say it together with the power and passion of Martin Luther King. I have a dream. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is the dreamer is refined. Now, according to Genesis 37:2, Joseph was a tattletale. He brought a bad report. Reuben hit me. Simeon is making faces at me. Benjamin's calling me names. And he was also a braggart. You guys are going to someday bow down to me. And Proverbs tells us there's 7 things that God hates. And Joseph had at least 2 of them. Pride and creating dissension among the brothers. Now, God cannot use somebody with those kind of attitudes. So the refinement begins with Joseph losing his coat. Now, at that time, a richly ornamented robe was a sign of leadership. And to Joseph, it was a symbol of his dream. In fact, he apparently never took it off. Where do we find Joseph and his richly ornamented robe? He is out with his brothers in the sheep pasture, traipsing through sheep doo-doo. That's just a bit pretentious. And so God uses Joseph's brothers to strip him of a symbol of his dream. But notice that God doesn't strip him of his dream, just the symbol. Doug Murin writes, in Keeping Your Dream Alive When They Steal Your Coat, know the difference between your dream and your coat. Your dream is a permanent calling from God that requires a process of cultivation for fulfillment. Your coat, whatever gives you status, is a temporary symbol that God may choose to take away. And the refinement continues. Not only is he stripped of his earthly status, he's tossed headfirst into a pit. A lot of refinement can happen in a pit. We get rid of our excess baggage. Our lives are kind of like overstuffed suitcases. We just keep packing more and more stuff in. And that's where a mission statement will keep you traveling light. If you're in the pit, you've got to slow down. In 1991, I had 4 surgeries in 3 hospitals in 2 months. And being tethered to an IV pole tends to slow one down. Although I did love that morphine pump. But anyway, in the pit, we have a lot of time to think. And so Joseph probably thought about his bragging, probably thought about squealing on his brothers, probably thought his dreams had bit the dust. And sometimes God allows us to go even lower than the pit. His brothers yell down, "Hey, the good news, Joey, we're going to not leave you in the pit. The bad news is we just sold you into slavery to Egypt." Now, Joseph is 17 at the time. If I did my math right, he spent 11 years in slavery to Potiphar. Now, notice, though, those 11 years are never wasted. Joseph is learning the Egyptian language and culture. He is learning management skills. God is using this time to mature and mellow this brash and boastful dreamer. But God isn't through refining him yet. Joseph's wife strips him of another coat, frames him for sexual harassment, and has him thrown in jail. At this point, it's easy to think the dream has indeed died. It has bit the dust, crashed and burned, bought the farm, bit the big one, pushing up daisies, passing on to glory, rung down the final curtain, met its final deadline, that fat lady has sung, and Elvis has left the building. No, that was good, because God was using Joseph not only in the pit and Potiphar's house, but in prison. Because God never wastes a single experience in my life and in your life. Here's a great thing. You may want to write this down. I'll tell you when to write things down so you don't have to worry about notes. Nothing terrible happens to authors, just terrific anecdotes. For example, I'm right in the middle of speaking at a large conference in Dallas. We're in a situation like this, a hotel. It's got the suspended ceiling. And as I'm speaking, there's this rustling noise above the suspended ceiling. And suddenly, here comes a worker through the ceiling, grasping onto a coaxial cable, bounces off a table, and lands in a lady's lap. And she starts laughing hysterically. But this is not the proper response. But she was a pastor. And she was struggling to come up with a good illustration for a sermon the next day. And what was her text? You're getting ahead of me, boys and girls. It was the paralytic whose friends take him to Jesus through the ceiling. So nothing terrible happens to authors, just terrific anecdotes. Now, I don't want to minimize whatever you are going through. I have had my share of terrible experiences. My wife nearly died giving birth to our daughter. I lost the perfect editing job due to corporate downsizing. I had a kidney stone that required 3 hospitals, 3 surgeries to pry that sucker loose. I've had cancer and radiation side effects, which my family dubbed radiation retardation. I think I'm over it. Parental purgatory with our children and more rejection slips than you can shake a memory stick at. Recently, someone on their blog complimented me on my wonderful writing. And I thought, what a true typo. Wonderful writing. It is only through our woundedness that comes wonderful writing. Writing that connects with our reader. I shared a message at my wife's church. She's a pastor. It was called, "I'm a mess, you're a mess. That's why we have a Messiah." And this woman came up to me, and you know, after all the good talk, she just grabbed hold of me with this bear hug. I'm so glad somebody else is a mess. And it was liberating for her. So nothing terrible happens to authors, just horrific anecdotes. And let me just, shameless commercial right here, out on the book table is Squeezing Good Out of Bad. It is the world's only, as far as I know, humor book on suffering and how God wants to use it. It's actually a top 10 list of the top 10 things to do when life gives you lemons. Number 8 is When Life Gives You Lemons, sell them on eBay. But the whole premise of the book is that these things that happen to us conform us to the image of Christ. I love Romans 8:28, but you have to read 29 too, because that tells you what the purpose is, and that is to be conformed to the image of Christ. So Squeezing Good Out of Bad at the bookstore there. And now back to our regularly scheduled program. 1994 was the coup de grace of spiritual refinement. Just a year earlier, Death and Beyond had gone into a second printing after just a month. I had won a Campus Life Book of the Year award. I had two literary agents. I'm putting my watch up here, which means absolutely nothing. But at least it'll keep me on track here. Two literary agents had wanted to represent me. I had a big-time booking agency that had promised a nationwide speaking tour. I had a Christian recording artist who was interested in my music. I was on staff of a growing church and major building plans. 1 year later, Death and Beyond had actually sold negative numbers. I called Karen Ball at Tyndale and said, "What is this, Karen, the Twilight Zone? How can you sell negative numbers?" She said, "Well, that just means that more stores sent it back than sold it." Oh, thank you. Click. Two opportunities from agents fell through. Basically, they said, "Till you got a big hit, we're not interested." Big-time booking agency had booked a total, grand total, of one engagement. And the four music publishers had turned down my music, and church attendance had plateaued. So as far as Coates' success, 1994 was the pit, Potiphar's house, and prison all in one. I was critically acclaimed and commercially ashamed. I was a good writer. At that time, I had 8 books, 1,000 articles in print, awards on the wall, had fan letters in the file. But I was a lousy Christian. I was a small-time author with a big-time ego. And since I didn't have a lot of book contracts and I had no speaking engagements, I had a lot of time to spend alone with God. And God does not waste those experiences. And for some reason, this pragmatic Protestant was drawn to Catholic mystics. I don't know why. But Brother Lawrence, Practicing the Presence of God, our only employment is to love God. What? It's not to write books? Our only employment is to love God? St. John of the Cross, The Dark Night of the Soul, to paraphrase him, he says, "We grow more in the pits than we ever do in the palaces." But it's not having a nationally famous television ministry? And Thomas Akempis, The Imitation of Christ, "Be content as an unknown." But I could be such a witness on Oprah, God. And to quote Judith Vore's classic children's story, "It was a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day." But here's a good thing. You write this down too. God is a refiner, not an arsonist. And through that time in 1994, I've never felt closer to God. I've never been more sure of my dream. At the same time, I've never been more unsure of how on earth that was going to come to fruition. So where are you in your dreams? Are you in the pit? Are you in Potiphar's house? Are you in prison? Are you in the palace? God is using you right now. Because say it with me, I have a dream. Let's say it together, boys and girls. I have a dream. Now, 13 years of refinement, 7 years as second to Pharaoh, it appears the dream is coming to fruition. The 7 years of abundance in Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began, just as Joseph had said. There was famine in all the other lands, but in the whole land of Egypt there was food. And all the country came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph, because the famine was severe in all the world. When Jacob learned there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, I love this, "Why do you just keep looking at each other?" What a bunch of dolts. He continued, "I have heard there's grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so we may live and not die." Then 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt. Now Joseph was the governor of the land and the one who sold grain to all its people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. Everyone lives happily ever after. End of story. Roll the credits.
That's good.
Well, you're fading on me. Let's try this one more time.
That's good.
All right. Well, it was good. But that's just barely the beginning of the story. The dream needs to be resized. This bowing down part in chapter 37 is a very minor subplot of the real story. Look at chapter 50, begin at verse 18. His brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. "We are your slaves," they said. But Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, what is now being done, the saving of many lives." Now Joseph at 17 only had a glimpse of that dream. At 37, he still doesn't have a clue of how big this dream is. Look at Matthew chapter 1. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. Then fast forward 42 generations. And Jacob the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called the Christ. Stop right there and let that sink in. Without Joseph's dream, starvation would have wiped out salvation. We would not be at a Christian writers' conference today if it was not for Joseph's dream. That is a big dream. And our dreams and goals are probably in need of some serious resizing, not because they are too big, but because they are sinfully small. Because what is promised in Ephesians 3:20? They told me this was absolutely idiot-proof, but they have found their idiot. There we go. Ephesians 3:20. God might possibly do an adequate work in our lives if we don't have too high expectations of his limited power. That's absolutely blasphemy, but that sometimes is how we view the power of God. No, he says this. God is able to do immeasurably more than all we can ask or imagine according to his power that is at work within us. And I tell you what, writers have got some serious imagination. Clint Kelly says, "You cannot outdream God." But here's the problem. Sir Francis Drake writes about disturbing dreams. He says, "Disturb us, Lord, when our dreams have come true because we have dreamed too little." How big is your dream? And if it is God's dream, it's going to disturb you. It is. Just ask New Testament Joseph. Your fiance is pregnant. And before he can catch his breath, incidentally, the father is God. And soon after the birth of his son, another disturbing dream. Herod is going to kill him, pack everything up, and leave for Egypt tonight. You see, I foolishly thought that communicating the gospel of Christ in as effective and creative manner as possible with as many people as possible meant I would be sitting at home with my laptop in my recliner writing books for an international audience. D.L. Moody said, though, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. I had no clue I would find myself teaching writing for 3 weeks in India, the land without toilet paper. I had no idea I'd find myself in my reporter's notebook covering the AIDS crisis in Zambia and having a dying man in a tiny hut say, "Please take my picture so you can pray for me." I had no idea my mission statement included speaking at conferences in Mozambique and in Swaziland, talking about biblical sexuality to a culture that doesn't even have a word for sexuality. The closest they have is sharing a blanket. We need to resize our sinfully small and carnally comfortable dreams about writing best-selling books and speaking to large audiences into a God-sized dream, something immeasurably bigger than we can ever imagine or ask for. And finally, the dream is revealed. Let me just quickly read an email that I got recently. "Your article on suicide saved my life tonight and showed me a path toward hope." Politicians believe that for every email they get, every letter they get, there are 1,000 constituents who feel the very same way, but never ever write. So take those occasional notes and emails you receive and know that there are 1,000 times more readers and listeners who feel the same way but never write. Your dream is 1,000, at least 1,000 times bigger than you realize. And so the dream is received. Write it down. Make it a part of your mission statement. Share that dream with your family, your church, someone in this conference. The dreamer is refined. I'm discovering that that refinement is a lifelong process. Philippians 1:9 promises us, "He who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion until the day of Jesus Christ." So for you who are looking for the soon return of Jesus Christ, my apologies. I am sure Christ is thinking, "That Watkins needs so much work, I cannot possibly return in his lifetime." And in my notes, I've done this probably 50 times at different conferences. I now have a page simply, "Recent Refining." Just last year, the Tuesday before I shared this Saturday at Colorado Christian Writers, I was told I had cancer. And so over the next 3 months, I was refined with 42 radiation treatments and the love and prayers of God's people. Cancer-free now. Praise the Lord. Just before going to Philadelphia Christian Writers Conference last year, my mom called to say my dad was being tested for Alzheimer's. My grandfather had a very, very serious case of dementia. Probably would have been Alzheimer if they had diagnosed it there. And that's just a bit disconcerting because it can be genetic. I may switch from writing nonfiction to writing fantasy and not even know it. And just yesterday, a 6-hour flight delay and was reassigned to the middle seat. I know. The dream is resized, and finally the dream is revealed. Remember, our influence is probably 1,000 times greater than we can see with our earthly eyes. So what I want you to do is to imagine a multitude that can't be numbered bowing down before Christ. Get that thought in our mind. Now, imagine, because of what he has done through you, thousands are there because of your dream.